Yes, it's that time of the week where we talk all things animals. And today I'm joined by Cheryl Shaw and Dr. David Tabbert. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And good afternoon.
Now, I'm going to start with David today instead of you, Cheryl.
Oh.
Because Mark Rourke would always ask you, what junket have you been on?
I thought I might have escaped that interrogation with Mark not being here, but Amanda, you've done well.
I have done well.
I have.
Proud.
And equally, I think Mark would be proud too that I can answer that I look. I don't call it a junket, a very educational conference, the Australian Veterinary Association National Conference. I attended last week in Brisbane.
So we're going to hear all about that today.
All the detail.
Wonderful, wonderful. And Cheryl, now you've got a pin on today that says I love dogs, so I'm assuming we're talking about cats.
No, we're not. And I know you would love that topic because you're a cat girl.
I am.
But we're going to be talking about dogs, and I'm going to be a bit of an advocate today for dogs when they're out walking.
Mm. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So in the meantime, we're going to talk about dogs today, Cheryl.
We are. And one of my pet hates is when you're out walking your dog and somebody comes along and says, oh, can I pat your dog? Well, you know, to me, it's really unfriendly because most dogs don't want to be greeted by strangers. For a lot of dogs, it can be really confrontational. And a thing that happens is that most dogs are happy with the people they know and their surroundings. And when they're out on a leash, they're actually being constricted to where they can go. So if somebody comes along and they put their hand out to touch the dog really hasn't got anywhere to go except either lunge forward and possibly bite the person or go backwards. Now, I know a lot of people say, oh, you know, can I pat your dog? And they do ask permission, which is the right thing to do because sometimes dogs are in training. Sometimes dogs aren't friendly when they're on a leash. They may be friendly in their own environment, but not on a leash. The other thing is sometimes dogs like guide dogs, they're working. So working dogs, we can't pat. And unfortunately, everybody thinks they have the right to go along and pat a dog. So we've got to pull that back a bit and we've got to start asking ourselves why we want to do that. Why can't we just acknowledge that the dog is a lovely dog? It might be a breed that you particularly like, say a Dachshund, and go, oh my gosh, your Dachshund's beautiful. Leave it at that. Don't put any pressure back on the dog. I think it's really important that we do understand that some dogs just are so uncomfortable that they will actually nip or bite when you put your hand forward. So Amanda, you were probably in that sort of bracket where when you were at school, people were teaching you to put your hand out and let your dog or the dog sniff your hand. Were you one of those
ones? Yeah, so, actually, when I was teaching at preschool, we had someone come in and you had to put your hand out and have a closed fist.
Mm. So the change of thought on that is that it's really quite a dangerous thing to do because when you put your hand forward, the dog actually thinks that, or some dogs think, that you're actually going to strike it and you're putting it into their face. Mm. Nobody likes anything in their face. I mean, we don't like someone to come up close to us because that's in our face and we back. And so for a dog, putting your hand forward into its face is really unfriendly. And this is where a lot of people get into trouble, and particularly if it's a child, because when it's a child, children tend to be quite awkward in their movements and they do things very rapidly. They also are high-pitched in their voices and they'll open their mouth like, ah, puppy. When they open their mouth, their eyebrows raise, their ears pin back a little bit. So our expression on our face is being interpreted from what the dog thinks we're doing. And the dog will actually sometimes think that, oh, wow, they're not so friendly. So we need to be careful. The other thing with children meeting a dog that you don't know, that they're down closer to the dog's face level and there's potential for them to be bitten, not just on the hand but in the face. So we really need to think, why is it that we're encouraging every dog our child meets to get a pat? We don't want to be doing that. The thing is too, if you do want to pat a dog and you've got permission from the owner, you have to make sure that you do it right. You know, keep your hand close to your body. Turn off to the side so you're not directly looking at the dog. Dogs hate confrontation with, you know, you staring in their eyes. They feel really conflicted by that. So if you're standing a little bit on the side and you move slowly, and then when you're going to pat the dog, don't pat it on the head as so many people do. Mm. The pat, pat, pat on the top of the head is really annoying to the dog. So we've got to make sure that when we're patting the dog, we're doing it in an area that the dog likes, either a long stroke along the shoulder down the back area, or where they really prefer, where the vagus nerve comes in, it actually makes the dog more relaxed and soothing, is patting underneath the chin or down on the chest. So they're areas that the dog will really enjoy being patted. And again, there's sometimes you've got to be looking, is the dog actually enjoying it? If the dog moves away from you, it's not enjoying it. If you start looking at signs that the dog is changing its body posture, it could be dipping down a little bit in the back, the tail may have gone between the legs, it may just be showing some really what they call whale eyes, where their eyes are open wide and you can see a lot of white. That's a sign to pull back, not to be, you know, touching the dog at all.
It's kind of like going up to a pregnant woman and saying, can I pat your belly? Like, you know.
Yeah, it's sort of inappropriate. Mm, yeah. And I think that a lot of dogs don't enjoy their walk as much as they should because they're being put into this predicament of the unknown person wanting to touch them. Look, when dogs meet other dogs, they don't meet nose to nose, because I know this saying, it's nose to nose leads to blows and nose to bums leads to chums. Because that's how dogs like to meet. It's the equivalent of our handshake. So, you know, we need to remember that going up to a dog in its face is just not on, and maybe just admire the dog a little bit more than all these people wanting to pat when we're out. Do you get a lot of problems with your dogs asking to get patted?
My dogs? Mm. Nobody wants to pat my dogs. No. Actually, something happened this morning, and so, you know, I've talked extensively on this show about some of the problems I've had with my dogs and their behaviour, so that's for another day. But one of my dogs is just ball mad at the park, but the other one is people-focused.
Oh, yep.
And one of the fellows on the park this morning, g'day Joel, had had a baby with him, and he went to give my dog a pat, which they've done before, but because the baby was there, Lucy was not happy and just moved away.
Yeah.
And it was kind of that expectation that, oh, I've patted her before, but see, now Lucy sees...
The dynamics have changed.
Lucy sees a different scenario. Oh, you've got a smelly little thing that makes a noise.
Yeah.
And sorry, Skip, that's you're not just a smelly little thing that makes a noise. As far as Lucy's concerned, what does a dog know about their environment? Mm. You know, we have to put ourselves into their shoes. If we can, I think it's really difficult. Mm. But, yes, it's all a bit strange.
It is.
Yeah. It's an interesting topic, isn't it?
Mm. Yes.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we better get on to it. We've got Steve from Abermain waiting. Thanks for holding, Steve. How can we help you today?
Hey, guys. I've got about a five-year-old dog. Now, I live, I've got him down the back of the yard. We have a laneway down the back, and I keep him down there because people walk through and everything. However, over night time, he's just barking a lot.
Yeah.
And he sort of, it's not even an aggressive bark. It's just a one bark here and there, which is like more of a, I don't know whether it's a scared thing or a, here I am.
Mm. Sort of a, what sort of breed of dog is he?
So he's a medium-sized dog. They told me when I got him he was a Dane cross something else.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, I just don't know. My wife's starting to have enough of it. Yep. You know, she's trying to sleep over night time and it just keeps waking her up.
It's not barking at wildlife.
Well, that's what I thought. You know, we almost back onto the reserve here, and it could be foxes or it could be anything running
possums
around up and down. But it's not one of those sort of barks that's you shouldn't be here bark. It's just one of them, you know, I'm here sort of a bark.
So do you have any other dogs or any other animals?
No.
No? And presumably we're exercising normally. Do you get to go out for walks during the day or at some time?
We do occasionally, but not all the time.
Yeah. I find, like, giving dogs a lot of environmental stimulation outside their own space, they start to feel a bit calmer because they've done their thing.
Yeah.
And so that's not going to make this problem go away altogether, but I think it always helps when they've had a bit of stimulation from a different environment. Kind of mixes things up a bit for them. The other thing is Amanda just asked about wildlife. I think any time at night I hear dogs barking, I think it's always going to be wildlife. The other thing you mentioned was it wasn't really that alert or alarm barking. It was kind of just letting you know. Sometimes that the way that you respond to the bark can also perpetuate some of that behaviour.
Yeah.
So I don't know, like, because she said he's down the back. Is there, are you calling out to him or is he coming closer to the house during the night?
No, it's not through the house. I mean, there is fences. So he sort of goes down the back. There's a pool which has got a fence, and then it's fenced off at the back and fenced off towards the laneway at the back as well. So he's got an area that's probably, I don't know, 6 metres wide by the whole width of the block.
Mm. You know? And where's he sleeping at night then?
So he has a kennel,
yeah,
and a blanket that's up underneath the carport.
Okay, so much closer to the house, and then he goes down the back to bark.
Well, he's just down the back all the time there.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Without looking at the environment, it's going to be hard to say. But I always think it's either an alarm,
yep,
or just that alert. Like alarm could be there's people around, and again, their hearing is so acute that they're going to hear things that you won't hear. Boredom, do they bark from boredom sometimes? But then you'd probably do that during the day as well.
It's not a lot through the day. I mean, if somebody was walking past or something like that, he would be up against the fence.
Yes.
But,
yeah.
Overnight, Tom, it's just a single bark. It's not, it's a yelp or a bark. I said to my wife, I don't know whether he's scared or whether he's just trying to let everyone know that he is in there.
Yes. And in which case, that's where we were thinking, is he alarmed or alerting? Because there might be some noise that he's hearing outside. I think if you get the opportunity to try and give him more stimulation during the day, as I said, with walking, the other thing is giving him a frozen Kong of an evening. Oh, yeah. So he's kind of got, no point going to bark if I'm busy working on this frozen Kong. So you need two, and fill them up with dog biscuits and wrap them up and put them in the freezer. And they'll, then spend the night working his way through that.
Well, I was going to ask, what are your thoughts on the citronella collars?
Oh, for like anti-barking?
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like he's doing a lot. And the other thing is, or not doing enough that a citronella collar might stop. The other thing is that citronella is kind of like an immediate distraction. But if the reason to bark is strong enough, you're still going to bark. It's not like he's, constantly got this habit of just over and over and over and over and over where you want to break the cycle. So it's more purposeful. Oh. And that's where I think, okay, well, let's give him another purpose.
Yeah. So I put a camera down the back to watch the driveway. And it seems to me like he's up and down like every 5 minutes. Looking around, getting up, looking around. Well, I think that's because he's probably sleeping most of the day.
Yep.
And then he's awake of a night.
He's awake at night. And there's probably, as I said, he's acute hearing. He's able to pick up on some things and he's just reacting to this. And good job on having the camera there. At least it gives you that evidence. But I'd like to see him get a bit more exercise. And I realise that's, time out of your day and so on. But I think he's probably going to repay you with more time at night if he's a little bit more tired.
Yeah.
So, and try the Kong as well. I think that's worth a shot too.
Good luck with it, Steve. Thanks so much for your call.
Appreciate that. Have a good day.
You too. Cheers. Bye. Thanks, Steve. And we've got Jill from Hawk's Nest on the line. Thank you for holding, Jill. How can we help you today?
Oh, yes. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm ringing because I have a female Labrador, Jess, who is 13 years old. She has arthritis, and in the last year, we've had to start taking her to the vet clinic once a month to have a Cardiferin injection. What we've started doing and what the vet clinics recommend is we don't need to see the vet. We can actually have a nurse administer the Cardiferin injection. What's been happening increasingly is when the nurses have been administering the injection, it's caused Jess a lot of pain, to the point where now when we go to the clinic once a month, Jess actually screams when the injection's administered. Mm. I have asked the question of the nurses why there is this difference. So last month, we actually had to have a review. So every 6 months, she has to have a review to make sure she's not having any significant reactions to the Cardiferin. And the vet actually administered the injection this time. No pain, no screaming, no howling. Today, she had to have, it was 4 weeks now since the vet did the last injection. She had it done by a vet nurse, and she screamed and howled. Mm. And I asked the nurse, why would this be the case when it's exactly the same medication that's been administered? And the nurse said to me that it could be that the medicine is actually cold and it's just come out of the fridge. And mm-hmm. I said, well, if this is the case, why isn't the medication taken out prior to my appointment so the medication doesn't cause this reaction from my dog? Because it's very distressing for me. Mm. So my question is, why the difference? Why when a vet does it, my dog doesn't scream and howl, and when the nurse does it, my dog's reacting this way? It's really very, very distressing for me.
And it can be distressing because obviously it's a helpful treatment and you want her to feel better with the arthritis, but equally we don't want her to, have any suffering associated with the treatment. So absolutely understand that aspect. As a veterinarian, I am often in the position of coming in after either before or after the nurses and doing stuff and just using my brain, making a decision and saying, let's do this drug and this thing and we'll do this treatment and so on. And then I leave and write up my notes and whatever and move along. And the nurses are the ones who then are given the responsibility to administer the treatment. So in this case, Jess sees the vet every 6 months, but then there's five visits with a nurse where the only thing that happens is I get a needle. So you might think, well, how does that change it? So pain is a very, very complex but a very sophisticated system to protect our body. And in most cases we think, if you cut yourself or you get injected or stabbed or something like that, well, that just triggers a pain response. And that's largely true. However, it's modified. So the signal comes up from the nerves and then it's modified and it's perceived in the brain. So for instance, and we see this a lot with certainly in human medicine as much as with veterinary medicine, where in your case, Jess, gets used to, whenever we see the nurse, well, only bad things are going to happen. And so already we're heightened and, as you said, anxious. And so when the nerve signal comes into the brain, it's amplified just simply because we know the nurse, the smell, the look, the sound of the nurse and so on is just going to trigger that amplification of that nerve signal. And even going to the vet with yourself, there's possibly, you're going with a visit with Jess and you say, well, we're going to see the vet. Okay, this will be good. We'll get a full review. You're going to walk in with a different kind of demeanor and attitude, and you're giving off different pheromones yourself that Jess is picking up on, compared to when you go in and go, oh, last time we went, it really hurt. Gee, I hope it doesn't hurt. I hope it doesn't hurt. Hopefully we won't be there long. And then you go in and Jess is like, oh, should we be worried? You seem worried. I should be worried. Maybe I'll be worried. Mm. This is going to hurt. So that's just kind of just one feature of the pain part. And what that does is there's a threshold that, when that nerve signal comes in. And once it gets through the threshold, as I said, it's amplified. The nurse actually described for you the temperature thing. One of the problems with getting it out too early is that the drug goes off, and the problem is if you don't turn up for whatever reason, then they have to discard that drug. So that's costly. So usually one of the things is they'll get the drug out when you arrive, and maybe that's probably the first lesson is, okay, I'm here, how about you get the drug out, and then we'll sit down for 10 minutes and just get everybody calm. And then at least the drug's got a bit of time to come up to room temperature in the syringe.
Yes.
The other thing is, and it, you mentioned it's just with one medication, but some medications have different acidity or pH level. So, for instance, lignocaine, which is a local anaesthetic, actually is quite painful to inject, only for a brief while, because then, you know, 2 seconds later it blocks the nerves. But it is actually slightly painful on injection. A lot of other things around dogs is if you're injecting in the same spot all the time, what's the skin like? Different regions of the body have different reactions. Do we massage the skin before and after the injection seems to help? Distracting Jess with treats and peanut butter or something can be helpful, again, because we're modifying that pain signal in the brain. And, of course, the other side of it is then the vet walks in and goes, hey, Jess, how's it going? And Jess is happy. And then, oh, we'll just give this injection and walk away. And it looks like they're doing something special. But I can tell you they're not doing anything special. So, but treats and massage, I reckon. Just double check too about how they prepare the drug when you get there, and maybe just taking a little bit longer to prepare before they actually administer it. And that'll probably, those three things I reckon will help.
David, there is something else I'd like to add to you, Jill. Sometimes some veterinarians have trouble with getting certain large breed dogs into their facility, and sometimes some of them will offer coming out to the car park or to the car, and that could help with Jess to overcome, you know, getting in there and that whole routine of the injection. So it may be something to think about as well as the things that David's been saying with you.
Yes, you know, the thing, Jess loves going to the vet. She did her puppy school training in the actual vet clinic reception area. So whenever we go to the, any vet clinic, Jess is in absolute heaven. She goes and licks the receptionist. She sniffs all the various food bags that they've got on display. She's excited to be there and just loves the vet clinic. So for us, it's sort of unusual that it's now changed.
Yeah.
But in what you're saying, what I have found, and I agree with you, in that when we went to the vet clinic for the vet review, she was in there, the vet was touching and patting her first, we were talking, and then at the end of the actual session, the injection was administered. But prior to that, she was just in there sniffing around, getting comfortable, had a treat beforehand, whereas when we see the nurse, it's straight in there. The nurse is standing there already with the needle, and it's, hello, Jess, and the needle is applied. So I sort of understand what
you're saying. Could be a bit scary.
I haven't actually thought of the change in the actual scenario when we just see the nurse to when we see the vet.
Yeah, and that, as I said, that all revolves around this model of pain as a experience and how it's modified. So it's not just about the nerve being stimulated in the tissue, it's also how it gets modified on the way up, and the brain then interprets that. So, you know, if we can change that experience, and as Cheryl said, even just a different environment, doing it in the car, maybe that helps. Maybe it doesn't make any difference, but it's worth changing a few of those things.
Yes, they're definitely going to try the massage and a treat beforehand.
Absolutely.
And maybe we get there and they take the medicine out of the fridge and we wait 10 minutes before they apply it.
Yeah.
And see if that makes a difference, because I tell you, I need to come home and have a calming pill.
Don't like to see it. But let us know how you get on, Jill. I'd be interested to hear how the next visit goes.
Yeah. I will. All right.
Righto.
Thank you very much for your time.
Good
Thanks,
on you.
Jill.
Thank you.
Bye. This is Pet Chat on 2NURFM 103.7. And we're going to look at our pets of the week. And we're going to start with Safi, a little 3-year-old short-haired black cat.
Safi. Double P, no E.
Yeah, I'd say Safi.
That's nice. That's nice. I love this description, Amanda, because apparently Safi is a lap cat.
Right.
And I always thought most cats were lap cats.
My cat's not a lap cat.
Oh.
Well, actually, no, she is sometimes, but she doesn't sit on my lap very often.
Oh, no, they always, it's up to them. That's the thing about cats.
That's right.
So apparently Safi's story is that she's settled in to her foster home at the moment and pretty easygoing. Sounds like a pretty chill kitty. And as far as we know, fine with other cats. She's been with other cats. We're not sure about dogs, but I think she'd be happy in on her own as a cat as well.
Yep. It says fine with a cat-friendly dog and a slow introduction.
I'm always worried about multi-cat households because we run into behavioural problems. But if Safi is going to get her best life, it's going to be where a human can be the lap upon which she rests.
Oh, I like that.
That's all they want from you is your lap.
Yeah. And food.
Yeah. And then don't touch me. Yes.
That's right, pretty much. Like a woman.
Not going there. Let's move along.
Okay, next we've got Ellie. And Ellie we've had before, probably about 6 months ago, I'd say.
Well, Ellie is a one-year-old boxer cross Staffy. And just having a look at Ellie and reading her bio, and anyone who's interested can go to the 2NUR website and make their way to Dog of the Week, Pet of the Week. So Ellie's probably, again, wants to snuggle up, but also a pretty energetic dog. So I think this is a different story. You've got to have the time and the space to make sure you can provide the level of engagement and stimulation so that Ellie's happy to settle in. And I noted in her bio it says she requires a minimum 30-minute morning walk to settle her into a daily routine. Don't we all?
No. I'd rather stay in bed. Thanks very much.
Okay.
So obviously Ellie's not for me, but, yeah, if you've got a bit of energy and you want to take Ellie out and, check her out, she's on the 2NURFM website at 2NURFM.com.au and you can check her and Safi out as well. Mm. Now, we've got a little bit of time, so we're going to talk about your junket.
I wish you'd Mark Rourke has a lot to answer for.
He does.
He's trained you well. It's not a junket.
Okay, sorry, your conference.
There might have been some junketing happening at different times. It was, look, as I mentioned, it was the National Conference of the Australian Veterinary Association. And they're always good value because one of the things that happened this year was, well, I've done it for the last couple of years, but I was invited to be a judge listening to presentations from research all across Australia. So I wanted to share, if I may, Amanda, some of the topics because it's not often that we talk about some of these things and I'm not sure I understand them all, but the presentations were great and I learnt so much about things that normally would not crop up on my radar and probably not on Pet Chat. But couple of important ones. So there was a very good presentation about a problem that we're seeing develop in dogs, or rather in hookworms, parasites of dogs, where they're developing resistance to antiparasitic medications. And you might think, well, you know, so what? Well, the problem is these hookworms can infect people.
Oh.
And if the host species is dogs and they're the ones we're treating, so they don't often occur in people, but when they do, they can cause blindness and skin problems and all sorts of things. And there's like a number of children infected every year with these migrating larval worms in their system. And it comes from infected grass or contaminated grass, I should say. So the management and the hopefully prevention of the development of this resistance is critically important. Moving along, so another one is you would see, Cheryl, lots of brachycephalic dogs. Mm-hmm. So some of the breeds would be
your pugs, your Pekingese.
Yes.
Yep, all of those little pushed in.
Bulldogs.
Smushes. Yep.
Right. And we know that a lot of them have airway problems, upper airway problems, and they require surgery. But surgery can be quite complicated in the recovery period. And there was a very interesting paper about the use of local anaesthetic in the upper airway and how did that impact their recovery. So fascinatingly, is that it helped the recovery of patients from the surgery. It didn't completely lower the complication rate, but it lowered the rate of ongoing problems with them post-operatively. So I thought that was really interesting because I think it's probably second nature to a lot of vets to use local anaesthetics in the upper airway, but nobody has ever documented and studied this. Very interesting one. Now, this is a bit left field. Fertility testing of bulls in Northern Australia.
Right.
I'm all over it.
I'm so all this one's for the farmers.
No, well, this it's actually the study was done up in far north Australia, but the impacts of this regarding an endemic disease called trichomonas, and it affects fertility, which, you know, creates all sorts of problems. So there's some really interesting impacts of management of that problem that are rapidly reducing the incidence of this fertility problem. And just finally, antimicrobial stewardship was a very big message. And if you haven't or have no understanding of what it is, it's let's be careful with antibiotics because one day we're going to run out of them. And that's animals and people. So big message there about antimicrobial stewardship.
Good advice. Thank you very much.
No worries. I'll go on another junket and come back. Sorry, conference.
We look forward to hearing about it next time. Thank you very much. This is Pet Chat. This is 2NURFM.